Chapter 27 Guts, the Decisive Ingredient. A long time ago, I took an oath never to write anything inoffensive. In working with literally hundreds of authors over a period of many years, I concluded that the single characteristic that most makes a difference in the success of an article or nonfiction book is the author's courage in revealing normally unspoken things about himself or his society. It takes guts to be a writer. A writer's job is to tell the truth in an interesting way. The truth is that adultery, theft, hypocrisy, envy, and boredom are all sins practiced everywhere that human nature thrives. What people who are not writers say to each other in everyday conversation is the speakable. What makes writing at its best interesting is the writer's willingness to broach the unspeakable, to say things that people don't ordinarily say. In fact, the best writers, those whose originality shines, tend to be those who are most outspoken. Do shy men and women ever become superb writers? Yes, after overcoming their natural reluctance to say the things they think. Fig leaves have no place on either the bodies or the minds of the best writers. I like the way Red Smith put it. There's nothing to writing. All you do is sit down at the typewriter and open a vein. On the issue of candor, is there something nonfiction writers can learn from novelists? Yes, there is hardly anything about the secret, sometimes mischievous, cruel, evil, outrageous, defiant, and glorious acts and thoughts of human beings that has not appeared in the novels of the last few decades. And there is little about the private acts of people that has escaped reporting, and not only in the sensational press. The novelist has it easier. He hides a little, just a little, under the presumption that he is making things up. We all know that the most truth-bearing parts of superior fiction aren't made up. They come from the novelist's observation and understanding of human nature. The nonfiction writer who dares to dare is more exposed. The assumption of his readers is that he is writing fact. He may have to prove his assertions to an editor, or worse, to a court. He needs the courage of a soldier or firefighter because, often, the more he reveals that is interesting to his readers, the more exposed he is. Readers are curious about the inmost secrets of others. The subjects of factual writing, if they are not publicity seekers, don't want anything embarrassing on public display. It is no accident that some of the best nonfiction writing of the century has come from writers who are also experienced novelists. Mary McCarthy, whose novels brought her fame, early on earned a reputation for keen observation and a sharp tongue for her critical writings. George Orwell's nonfiction is far superior to his fiction and exceptionally outspoken. Critics have called him the best nonfiction writer of this century. V.S. Naipaul's fiction, once sampled, will lead you quickly to conclude that he has the courage to see and say what, for instance, politicians almost never say. His nonfiction makes waves by being sharply observant and truthful in territory that frightens off lesser writers. Rebecca West, whom Time magazine called indisputably the world's number one woman writer, started out as a novelist and 6 decades later was still writing fiction. However, her great reputation rests largely on her shrewd, brave, and intelligent factual writing. Most writers know Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, but haven't read his gutsy nonfiction in The Crack-Up. Writers read writers, and if being outspoken is a problem for you, I suggest you immerse yourself in the work of the writers I've mentioned, and also try the work of contemporaries like Gore Vidal and Joan Didion, even if it's just to sample how they deal with candor. Vidal, who has never wanted for vitriol, much less candor, begins one piece about Tennessee Williams by passing the candor chalice to Williams, whom he quotes saying, "I particularly like New York on hot summer nights when all the, superfluous people are off the streets." Borrowing the candor of another has been useful to Joan Didion also. I quote from Goodbye to All That, a memoir of her pilgrimage to New York when she was 23. I remember once, one cold, bright December evening in New York, suggesting to a friend who complained of having been around too long that he come with me to a party where there could be, I assured him with the bright resourcefulness of 23, new faces. He laughed, literally, until he choked, and I had to roll down the taxi window and hit him on the back. "New faces," he said finally. "Don't tell me about new faces." It seemed that the last time he had gone to a party where he had been promised new faces, there had been 15 people in the room, and he had already slept with 5 of the women and owed money to all but 2 of the men. Next, let's sample someone not as well known. Gail Pemberton, a black writer with a Ph.D. from Harvard, wrote about the time she was going broke in Los Angeles on a temporary typist revenue and signed up to work for a caterer on 3 successive weekends. What she later wrote about it made the experience worthwhile. Our caterer was one of a new breed of gourmet cooks who do all preparation and cooking at the client's home, none of your cold-cutter, warming-tray catering. As a result, her clients had a tendency to have loads of money and even more kitchen space. Usually her staff was not expected to serve the meal, but on this occasion we did. I was directed to wear stockings and black shoes, and I was given a blue-patterned apron dress with frills here and there to wear. Clearly, my academic lady banker pumps were out of the question, so I invested in a pair of trendy black sneakers, which cost me $5 less than what I earned the entire time I worked for the caterer. Buying the sneakers was plainly excessive, but I told myself they were a necessary expense. I was not looking forward to wearing the little French serving girl uniform, though. Everything about it and me were wrong, but I had signed on, and it would have been unseemly and downright hostile to jump ship. One thing I liked about the caterer was her insistence that her crew not be treated as servants. That is, we worked for her and took orders from her, not from the clients, who might find ordering us around an emboldening and socially one-upping experience. She also preferred to use crystal and china she rented, keeping her employees and herself safe from a client's rage in case a family heirloom should get broken. But on this occasion, her client insisted that we use his baccarat crystal. We were all made particularly nervous by his tone. It was the same tone I heard from a mucky muck at my studio typing job, cold, arrogant, a matter-of-fact, you-are-shit attitude that is well known to nurses and secretaries. As Pemberton was drying one of the baccarat glasses, it shattered in her hand, a happy accident in that she used it as the fulcrum of her piece. Characteristic of another kind of nonfiction gutsiness is that of Seymour Crimm, who wanted, as many writers do, to be a major novelist, and instead made exemplary nonfiction his calling. "One life was never quite enough for what I had in mind," he says, and means it, as he lays his life bare. Listen to the individual sound of his voice. You may sometimes think that everyone lives in the crotch of the pleasure principle these days except you, but you have company, friend. I live under the same pressures you do. It is still your work or role that finally gives you your definition in our society, and the thousands upon thousands of people who I believe are like me are those who have never found the professional skin to fit the riot in their souls. Many never will. I think that what I have to say here will speak for some of their secret life, and for that other sad America you don't hear too much about. This isn't presumption so much as a voice of scars and stars talking. I've lived it and will probably go on living it until they take away my hot dog. The voice picks up speed. America was my carnival at an earlier age than most, and I wanted to be everything in it that turned me on, like a youth bouncing around crazed on a boardwalk. I mean literally everything. I was as unanchored a kid as you can conceive of, an open fuse box of blind yearning, and out of what I now assume was unimaginable loneliness and human hunger, I greedily tried on the personalities of every type of the national scene as picked up through newspapers, magazines, movies, radio, and just nosing around. It should be evident by now that forthrightness doesn't involve sensationalism suitable for the exploitation tabloids. What it requires is honesty of a kind that gets self-suppressed by the public. Doctors are part of that public, but not doctors who are good writers. Witness Richard Seltzer's chapter, The Knife, in his book Mortal Lessons, Notes on the Art of Surgery. He does what no surgeon has done before, with precision, clarity, grace, imagination, and candor. One holds the knife as one holds the bow of a cello or a tulip, by the stem, not palmed, nor gripped, nor grasped, but lightly, with the tips of the fingers. The knife is not for pressing, it is for drawing across the field of skin. Like a slender fish, it waits at the ready, then go. It darts, followed by a fine wake of red, the flesh parts falling away to yellow globules of fat. Even now, after so many times, I still marvel at its power, cold, gleaming, silent. More, I am struck with a kind of dread that it is I in whose hand the blade travels, that my hand is its vehicle, that yet again this terrible steel-bellied thing and I have conspired for a most unnatural purpose, the laying open of the body of a human being. Are readers ready for this kind of candor? In 1994, another physician who writes well, Sherwin B. Newland, published a book called How We Die. It was selected by a book club, became a bestseller, and won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. Did I have to search through my library to find the examples of frankness quoted in this chapter? They are all from one section of a single anthology I recommend to you, The Art of the Personal Essay, edited by Philip Lopate. That book starts with the forerunners, Seneca and Plutarch, picks up with Montaigne and Samuel Johnson and Hazlitt en route to the Americans of the present century, and that journey reveals an evolution toward the candor with which our writers tell us like it is. The audience is ready. The question is, are you? Part 5. Literary Values in Fiction and Nonfiction. Chapter 28. Commercial? Popular? Literary? The commercial novelist is a storyteller who is most concerned with plot and plot gimmicks, with maintaining a high level of suspense and physical action. The success of commercial novelists is usually derived from tapping an area of adventure, romance, espionage, or whatever may be popular at the time, creating characters with sufficient skill that the reader is willing to suspend disbelief and follow the hero as he triumphs over unambiguous antagonists. John Grisham's bestseller, The Firm, for instance, is an adolescent fantasy, the story of a young lawyer straight out of law school who was offered a job without too much pay, an expensive car, a house, and finds himself working, of course, for the mob, who won't let him quit. The rest is a chase scene. The market for adolescent fantasies is demonstrably huge, and it cares little about the quality of the writing. Mitch is the beleaguered hero of this fantasy. Mitch almost felt for her, but he kept his eyes on the table. In a box? What he kept on the table was presumably his gaze. He stared at Royce McKnight and exposed a mammoth chip on his shoulder. That's not a log, it's an attitude. Mitch ripped two ribs apart, slinging sauce into his eyebrows. Did his wife Abby, sitting across the table from him in the restaurant, notice? She says, "We just moved in this morning." A fact he already knows, so Mitch says, "I know." On a business trip, Mitch, happily married to Abby, is the object of seduction by a woman named Julia in words like these. Julia drooled at him and moved closer. She rubbed her breasts on his biceps and gave her best seductive smile only inches away. When a private school is mentioned, we learn, affluent parents signed the waiting list shortly after birth. Precocious as well as affluent? According to Grisham, the people Mitch meets have interesting, though repetitive, characteristics. He frowned sincerely, as if this would be painful. He was stocky, with a slight belly, thick shoulders and chest, and a huge, perfectly round head that smiled with great reluctance. When he talked, the water dripped from his nose and interfered with his enunciation. Tammy arrived from trip three out of breath and with sweat dripping from her nose. In this kind of commercial writing, lack of precision is not the only carelessness. Coffee? Yes, he said, black. She disappeared and returned with a cup and saucer. The coffee itself was presumably forgotten by the author, and so it goes. The public was forgiving, or more likely, didn't notice as the firm topped the bestseller lists. The most distinguishing difference between commercial writers like Grisham and literary writers is the attention paid to the individual meanings and resonance of words and the respect shown for the reader's intelligence. In this chapter, my concern is with the craft of the writer who aspires to permanence, who has not an occupation but a calling. Publishing, the work of bringing words to the marketplace, is, alas, sloppy in its attempts to distinguish books of a certain quality from everyday product that is designed to sell. The latter are called popular and commercial, though books of high quality are sometimes popular, and when they endure, prove their commercial viability by continuing to sell long after their commercial contemporaries are out of print. Both kinds of books can entertain and instruct, though they appeal to different audiences. A prevalent way of describing the difference is calling the successful commercial book a good read, whereas the other is likely to be referred to as a good book. The implication is that one confers a transient experience on the reader, whereas the other may be durable, deserving the permanence of a hardcover binding and a place on a bookshelf, to remind one of the experience or to be reread. I want to clarify the distinction for a practical reason. In the end, you write what you read. If you read literary fiction with pleasure, that's what you will attempt to write. If you read thrillers or romances, you will, in all likelihood, end up writing for the audience of which you are a part. The same is true for nonfiction. Not merely the field of interest, but the quality of language and insight you require of your books, read or written. The literary novelist is concerned primarily with character understood in depth and engaged in activities that are resonant with the ambiguities and stresses of life. The richness of the best literary fiction is derived primarily from the creation of characters who will persist in the reader's mind after the reading experience is over. Those novelists and nonfiction writers who strive to produce durable work share an interest in precision and freshness in the use of words, in insights into human nature and the physical world, and in resonance. These writers usually develop a voice or style that is distinctive. The writer of commercial nonfiction is often an expert craftsman in a hurry to meet a deadline who measures the effort put in against the monetary reward. He is writing not for the ages, but to put bread on the table. Perfecting a piece beyond the requirements of the editor, to him, means more work for the same amount of money, work that could well go into another piece for another publication. Beyond a certain point, quality is not cost-effective for him. Fiction writers who don't improve their work beyond the requirements of their editors or the public do not have an interest in perfection, because they are deaf to the sound of words and have no instinct or training to hunt precise nuances. They are what they read. I have edited and published both kinds of writers and both kinds of books. I have worked closely with writers of each kind who have made millions from a single work. What I have never witnessed is a writer's work succeeding notably in a field he doesn't habitually read for pleasure. Diction is a word laymen associate with clear pronunciation. Its other meaning is the one that is important for writers. Diction involves the choice of words for their precise meaning and sound, the arrangement of those words, and their selection for effect. Excellence in diction is the most important characteristic of fine writing. The precise meaning of words matters, a notion in disuse by the majority of people, including their presumptive leaders. The inattention to diction is pervasive, endemic, and has reached into surprising places. On the morning that this chapter was written, the New York Times published a review of a biography of General H. Norman Schwarzkopf, the leader of Desert Storm. The co-authors were both journalists. The review tells us that the authors, in their introduction, say they will paint a picture of a man who is human, blunt, clear, idealistic, and swiftly effective. I was stopped by the first adjective, human. I hadn't thought of the general as vegetable, mineral, or other species of animal. What did these two journalists intend by leading with the word human? We'd have to guess. Surely they didn't confuse it with the word humane, which means something quite different. Did they mean Schwarzkopf was what in colloquial parlance we call a regular guy? And if so, what is meant by a regular guy? It's a verbal trunk into which 100 readers would pile many meanings relating to their own experience. In the best of newspapers, the best of journalists are usually forced to write quickly. Off the top of the head is the convenient expression, and that's where an imprecise use of human comes from. Speed and a minimum of thought, for surely both experienced authors of the Schwarzkopf biography know better. Poetry and fiction share certain characteristics. In fashioning poetry, a common beginner's mistake is to emote instead of to evoke, to convey the writer's emotion rather than to stimulate an emotion from the reader. The way to a reader's emotion is to bring two words together that have not been together before. Therefore, precision is achieved in poetry by the creation of a new grouping of words rather than by using each word for its exact meaning. Precision in poetry is abetted by the sound of words, which is why poetry is sometimes so difficult to translate. The work of Dylan Thomas, possibly the best poet in the English language of this century, is full of newness, words juxtaposed for the first time to create a new meaning. In one, Fern Hill, he speaks of the lilting house. Lilt means a tune having a pleasant rhythm. A poor poet might have written happy house, which is direct and obvious. The lilting house evokes the happiness. If it's hard to judge out of context, treat yourself sometime with Dylan Thomas's poems. Poetry usually involves austere compression. The most famous poem of Delmore Schwartz, In the Naked Bed in Plato's Cave, mixes ordinary description, a fleet of trucks strained uphill grinding, with fresh metaphor, the street lamp's vigil. The street lamp is given a human characteristic, vigilance, with a single word. In fiction, the group of words that evoke an emotion in the reader can range from a few words, as in poetry, to paragraphs or sections. In commercial fiction, the sound of words is rarely considered except for the occasional and inaccurate splat or rat-a-tat-tat. In literary fiction, the sound of words can contribute to the effect, though that is rarely noticed by readers. Literary fiction thrives on subtlety and particularity. Particularity is a word my students hear often. Once the word from editors was be concrete. But to be specific is not as precise as to be particular, which is much more advantageous to the creative writer. Particularity deserves its own chapter, which comes next. Chapter 29. Particularity. In his book On Becoming a Novelist, John Gardner said, "Detail is the lifeblood of fiction." My only quarrel with that statement is that detail is also the lifeblood of nonfiction. And I want to go a step further. It is not just detail that distinguishes good writing. It is detail that individualizes. I call it particularity. Once you're used to spotting it, and spotting its absence, you will have one of the best possible means of improving your writing markedly. During the decades that I served as an editor and publisher, what drew my attention to a piece of work more than any other factor was the use of apt particularities, the detail that differentiates one person from another, one act from another, one place from any others like it. Let's look at some examples of particularization in sketching characters, actions, and places. To characterize, particularity is used to show how an individual looks, dresses, or speaks without resort to clichés or generalizations. Early in The Touch of Treason, the lawyer Thomasy is confronted by Roberts, the patrician district attorney. Watch for the words that particularize. Thomasy could see Roberts' handshake coming at him all the way down the aisle. Above it, that freckled face proclaiming, "I can be friendly to everybody. I was born rich." Roberts' smile, Thomasy thought, is an implant. The cop-out would have been to say that Roberts had a fake smile. That is a tired expression and a generalization that doesn't particularize. The particularization is achieved in two steps. First, his freckled face proclaiming, "I can be friendly to everybody, I was born rich." Then Thomasy's thought that the smile is an implant. Note the use of metaphor to particularize. It doesn't say Robert's smile is like an implant. Thomasy thinks it is an implant. Of course, Thomasy doesn't believe that literally. In just a few sentences, we know that in Thomasy's view, Roberts is a pretentious prig. The particularization, though brief, is enough to convince the reader. That helps set up the adversarial exchange that follows. Let's observe an action that particularizes. Thomasy moved his gaze from Roberts' confident eyes to Roberts' blonde hair, then Roberts' chin, then Roberts' left ear, then Roberts' right ear, the four points of the cross. It was what made witnesses nervous. They couldn't figure out what you were doing. You weren't doing anything except making them nervous. The reader quickly understands that Thomasy disconcerts his opponents. Roberts must loathe Thomasy, the arrogant son of an Armenian immigrant. When they encounter each other in the courtroom, the reader is prepared for a battle that is motivated by more than the case. Now let's examine the use of particularization in describing a place. The renting agent said it was their last best chance of finding an apartment in the neighborhood that wasn't as cramped as the place they had now. Elizabeth and Joe hurried up the stone steps to the parlor floor. The agent stepped aside to let them in. Their first impression was a vast emptiness in which the echo of the agent's voice reverberated. "It's 14 feet high." They followed the agent's gaze to the ceiling, with its tiny plaster angels around the perimeter. Joe said, "There's room for astronauts. How do you change the light bulbs?" Elizabeth said, "With a ladder, dummy." The agent, glad to see the wonder on their faces, said, "Wait till you see the bedroom." "Is it in the same town?" Joe said, squeezing Elizabeth's hand. A lazy author might have said, "The apartment was bigger than they ever expected." The reader would not have been able to experience the wonder of its size. By stretching out the particulars, the echo of the agent's voice, the height of the ceiling, the carved plaster angels, the reader experiences the place along with the characters. In addition, the dialogue also particularizes one of the characters. Joe, for instance, has a sense of humor. If an ordinary object is important to a story, particularization will help call attention to it. Let's look at a before and after example. "You have an envelope?" He put one down in front of her. This exchange is void of particularity. Here's how the transaction was described by John Le Carré. "You have a suitable envelope?" "Of course you have." Envelopes were in the third drawer of his desk, left side. He selected a yellow one, A4 size, and guided it across the desk, but she let it lie there. Those particularities, ordinary as they seem, help make what she is going to put into the envelope important. The details do not consist of waste words. They have a purpose in making the transaction credible. It should be clear by now that particularizing sometimes takes more words than a quick generalization. For several decades, there has been pressure in nonfiction to clip language short, to simplify sentences. The movement seems to have started back in 1946 with Rudolf Flesch's book, The Art of Plain Talk. Simplification is useful and can be a great aid to those business persons and academicians who tend to inflate their sentences with excess verbiage and pompous jargon. However, simplification is not necessarily appropriate if one's aim is to provide an experience for the reader. The apartment was large doesn't do it, nor does putting an envelope in front of somebody. The extra words are not wasted because they make the experience of the action possible and credible. Excellence in particularity tells the editor that he is in the hands of a writer. I've seen the use of particularity make an article on a mundane subject sing on the page. The nonfiction books I edited that became classics all had the quality of particularity. And for fiction, particularity is not an option because even transient fiction requires some particularity to succeed with readers. Perhaps my favorite example of particularization is the first sentence of one of Graham Greene's masterpieces, The Heart of the Matter. It has three words every writer would do well to remember. Wilson sat on the balcony of the Bedford Hotel with his bald pink knees thrust against the ironwork. The crucial words, of course, are bald pink knees, a particularization that makes the character and the place instantly visible and, in the reader's experience, unique. If we were to eliminate the words bald and pink, how diminished that opening sentence would be. Wilson sat on the balcony of the Bedford Hotel with his knees thrust against the ironwork. By removing the two most particular words, the sentence becomes ordinary. Moreover, though the image is still visual, there's nothing especially memorable about it. The balcony and the Bedford Hotel are also particulars, as is the ironwork, but bald pink knees is fresh, original, and immediately makes Wilson visible. Those knees against the ironwork make the hotel visible, too. All of that is accomplished in a single sentence. Particularizing is also useful if you have occasion to repeat something, like a character laughing, and don't want to bore the reader by repeating a phrase like, "She laughed several times within the same few pages." "She looked like she was enjoying herself mightily." If he laughed behind you suddenly in a darkened room, you'd be frightened. His face beamed like Santa Claus, his barrel chest moving up and down, but I couldn't hear him laughing. She seemed about to giggle like a schoolgirl, but controlled it. She'd been out of school a long time. His response was a sound somewhere between a guffaw and a chortle. Later I learned it was a kind of trademark with him. Nobody else in the world laughed like that. The temptation is always to use either a cliché or a generalization, what I call top-of-the-head writing. In this chapter, we are trying to fashion sentences that are writerly, that particularize in an interesting way. Here's a top-of-the-head description that doesn't tell us much. Cecilia wore short skirts. It doesn't take much to turn that ordinariness into a sentence that characterizes and particularizes. Cecilia's skirts were 3 inches shorter than her age allowed. Here's another ordinary, I'm tempted to say lazy, sentence. Vernon was a heavy smoker. And now several ways to convey the same point with particularity. Vernon coughed from the ground up. When a waitress heard Vernon's voice, she always guided him to the smoking section without asking. Vernon looked like those fellows that have one rectangular breast where he kept his pack of Marlboros tucked into his shirt. Here's a sentence that doesn't give the reader anything to see. It's too much of a generalization. He didn't know what to do with his hands. If you're going to deal with a character's hands, give them something to do, as this author did. Every few minutes his right hand checked to see that his reproductive organs were still in place. A useful technique for particularizing a character in fiction, a person in nonfiction, or a setting in either, is seeing the individual or locale first at a distance and then closer. For the reader, the experience is similar to seeing a full-length view of a person and then a close-up in which more detail is noted. Corrigan's bulk filled the doorway. I said hi and got up from behind my desk quickly to shake his hand. I stopped. His right arm was in a sling. He wiggled the fingers at me. "Break it?" I asked. His lips, trying to smile, quivered. "What happened?" I said, motioning him to a chair. He turned his face toward the window. I saw the freshly stitched cut that ran from his right cheek straight down into the collar of his shirt. When a person comes into view, the writer's temptation is to describe him all at once. It's more effective to delay part of the description. Start at a distance, then notice more. It enhances the tension. The same technique of particularizing in stages works for places as well as people. Elmore Leonard, best known for his dialogue, is also a master of particularity. Robbie Daniels was also 41. He had changed clothes before the police arrived, and at 6 o'clock in the morning wore a lightweight navy blue cashmere sweater over bare skin, the sleeves pushed up to his elbows, colorless cotton trousers that clung to his hips but were not tight around the waist. Standing outside the house, talking to the squad car officer, the wind coming off the ocean out of misty dawn, he would slip a hand beneath the sweater and move it over his skin, idly, remembering, pointing with the other hand toward the swimming pool and patio where there were yellow flowers and tables with yellow umbrellas. My favorite particularity in the passage we just read is, he would slip a hand beneath the sweater and move it over his skin, idly remembering, pointing with the other hand toward the swimming pool and patio where there were yellow flowers and tables with yellow umbrellas. I suppose Rudolph Flesch of The Art of Plain Talk would have had Elmore Leonard say something like, he scratched the skin under his sweater. But the quality of the writing would have flown with the rest of the words. In writing, the word diction refers to the choice of words, which is the activity of the writer as he is particularizing. The requirement is precision of meaning, le mot juste, exactly the right word. Here's an example from a recent newspaper story. Pickpockets board trains, wait until the exquisitely perfect last second, and then step off. If anybody else does it, he's a cop. The lazy writer's cliché would have been, pickpockets wait until the last second. Instead, the journalist avoided the cliché and sharpened the meaning by calling it the exquisitely perfect last second. His diction has brought a freshness to the piece. Books of quality that make the nonfiction bestseller list and earn considerable sums for their authors almost always employ as much particularity as possible. They deserve study. An hour spent in the library just looking at opening pages of memorable recent nonfiction can be instructive. Here is the opening of the book that fared better than the other D-Day books commemorating the 50th anniversary of that event in 1994. D-Day, June 6, 1944, The Climactic Battle of World War II, by Stephen E. Ambrose. At 0016 hours, June 6, 1944, the Horsa glider crash-landed alongside the Caen Canal, some 50 meters from the swing bridge crossing the canal. Lieutenant Den Brotheridge, leading the 28 men of the 1st Platoon, D Company, the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry Regiment, British 6th Airborne Division, worked his way out of the glider. He grabbed Sergeant Jack Bill Bailey, a section leader, and whispered in his ear, "Get your chaps moving." Bailey set off with his group to pitch grenades into the machine gun pillbox known to be beside the bridge. Lieutenant Brotheridge gathered the remainder of his platoon, whispered, "Come on, lads," and began running for the bridge. The German defenders of the bridge, about 50 strong, were not aware that the long-awaited invasion had just begun. Note the particularity with which Ambrose engages the reader. Particularity is not only the essence of fine writing, it is sometimes rewarded by the gratitude of reviewers and readers, who can make bestsellers and classics of books whose authors pay attention to detail and the precise meaning of words. A book can be said to be an accumulation of paragraphs. You work on one paragraph at a time. If you perfect a single paragraph, you have a model for a book. Such is the paragraph I'd like you to look at next. It's not by a famous author, it's by a student of mine, Linda Catmarian, who has yet to publish her first work. Observe how she uses particularity. Weeds and the low-hanging branches of unpruned trees swooshed and thumped against the car while gravel popped loudly under the car's tires. As the car bumped along, a flock of startled blackbirds exploded out of the brush. For a moment they fluttered and swirled about like pieces of charred paper in the draft of a flame, and then were gone. Elizabeth blinked. The mind could play such tricks. What's going on here? She's breaking rules. Adjectives and adverbs, which normally should be cut, are all over the place. They're used to wonderful effect, because she uses the particular sound of words. The low-hanging branches swooshed and thumped against the car. Gravel popped. Startled blackbirds exploded out of the brush. They fluttered and swirled. We experience the road the car is on because the car bumped along. What a wonderful image. The birds fluttered and swirled about like pieces of charred paper in the draft of a flame. And it all comes together in the perception of the character. Elizabeth blinked. The mind could play such tricks. Many published writers would like to have written a paragraph that good. That nearly perfect paragraph was achieved with a small amount of editing and revision. The value of writing that paragraph lay, first, in giving her proof that she could do it, and, second, in giving her a benchmark for rethinking and revisiting the rest of her book. A good place to practice particularizing is in letters to friends. Once upon a time, letters were an art form. Today, many people write top-of-the-head letters full of generalizations and clichés. Many of us think of clichés as something we learned all about in school. The fact is that some of the best educated writers fall back on clichés both in their speech and work much more often than they realize. For a fiction writer, learning to avoid them and finding those that slip in are important steps toward learning one of the most important aspects of original creative work. Examining each word for its precise meaning and the likely effect of every group of words on the emotions of the reader. For a writer, top-of-the-head writing, even letter writing, is dangerous because the habit could carry over into your work. If you work at particularizing in all of your personal correspondence, the recipients will enjoy what you write much more, and you will be practicing what you need to perfect to get your books published and to build an audience for your writings. You'll remember my saying that commercial fiction, too, can benefit from particularity. If you'd like to have some fun putting your knowledge of particularity to the test, you'll need pen and paper or have your word processor turned on. Here are the first two paragraphs of a novel I will ask you to improve. At 6:30 on a Friday evening in January, Lincoln International Airport, Illinois, was functioning, though with difficulty. The airport was reeling, as was the entire Midwestern United States, from the meanest, roughest winter storm in half a dozen years. The storm had lasted 3 days. Now, like pustules on a battered, weakened body, trouble spots were erupting steadily. That opening lacks particularity. Meanest, roughest, and trouble spots are generalizations. The simile, like pustules on a battered, weakened body, is an inaccurate analogy and is off-putting in the opening paragraphs of a book. Given the generality of a long-lasting snowstorm and your likely experience of airports, how would you revise those two paragraphs to give the opening of the novel particularity? Feel free to change or discard as much as you like. Your revision can be shorter or longer. Remember what John Gardner said, "Detail is the lifeblood of fiction." Use actions if possible. If people are in your opening, have them talk or think in particulars. Make locale, objects, and people distinctive and visible. Use other senses if appropriate, and make it ominous if you can. Stop when you're pretty sure you've improved the opening. If you like your version better than the author's original, I have a surprise for you. You have just revised the opening of one of the biggest bestsellers of our time, Airport, by Arthur Haley. I tried my hand at a more particularized version of Arthur Haley's opening, based on the author's own facts, scattered in the first three pages of the book. Note how particularizing and introducing a character help increase the tension of that opening paragraph. Runway 30 at Lincoln International was out of service. Blocked by an Aero Mexican 707, its wheels mired in waterlogged ground near the runway's edge. Incoming traffic from Minneapolis, Cleveland, Kansas City, Indianapolis, and Denver was stacked up overhead, some low on gas. On the ground, the wings of 40 planes chafing to take off were icing up. At the snow control desk high in the glass-walled control tower, Mel Bakersfield, the airport's general manager, drummed his fingers on the glass and peered into the darkness, as if he could will United's Flight 111 from Los Angeles to appear. The plane was due at 4:30. It was now 6:30. Chapter 30. Similes and Metaphors. Similes and metaphors are the wonders of writing, and, like all wonderful things, carry a price. If figures of speech are overdone, they backfire. For instance, here's Martin Cruz Smith in his bestseller Polar Star, straining to get a metaphor and a simile into two successive sentences. In the glare of the lamp, Volovoy's crew cut was a crown of radiant spikes. Of course, Carp, who was doing all the heavy labor, perspired like Vulcan at the forge. What we see is not Volovoy's crew cut or Carp's perspiration, but the author laboring to provide comparisons unsuccessfully. At one point, he stages a fight, and hero Arcady gets shoved into a bookcase, which inspires this simile. Paperbacks fluttered out like birds. I'll bet. The simile is imprecise. Smith can't restrain himself. Here he goes again. Her black eyes balanced anxiety on enormous cheekbones. When read aloud, the vision of black eyes balancing on cheekbones always draws a laugh. That's not a simile or metaphor, just plain overwriting. Which leads me to the principal advice I have for writers striving for color. Try, fly, experiment, but if it shows strain, if it isn't accurate, cut it. Inaccurate similes and metaphors have the effect of deflecting the reader's attention from the story to the words on the page. Yet when carried off, especially when a simile is original and a metaphor sings, there is no greater glory in the practice of words. In school, we learned that a simile is a comparison of two unlike things, usually joined by the words like or as. Perhaps the unlike throws off writers. What is meant is that the writer shows, by simile, the similarity of two things that were previously not connected. Simile. She sprang up like a jack-in-the-box when the doorbell rang. We identify a jack-in-the-box popping up with suddenness. But if it said, she sprang up suddenly, we'd lose the savor of the comparison. In a metaphor, a word or phrase is implied to something that is figuratively rather than literally similar. This figure of speech results when words or phrases are brought together that do not ordinarily belong together, yet by their proximity convey a fresh meaning. Metaphor. His bicycle had wings. The bicycle was going so fast it seemed like a bird in flight, or it was pedaled with elan as if it were airborne. As we've seen earlier, some of the best novel titles are metaphors. The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. We easily recognize the truth of such analogies. In commercial fiction, the author often uses top-of-the-head similes and metaphors. Simile. He felt like $1 million. Metaphor. It was food for thought. Those examples are clichés, tired from overuse. Most good writing is characterized by a careful use of precise and sometimes original similes and metaphors. Simile. He felt as if he were a teenager for whom illness and death were abstractions. Metaphor. The thought hovered over him, waiting for his permission to descend. One of the hazards is, of course, the mixed metaphor, in which two or more unrelated metaphors are unsuccessfully combined. He was dog-tired, but still feeling his oats. Nancy Kincaid knows how to pick the right metaphor for her barefoot youngsters. Melvina's wild boys were all just barefoot as the day is long, not wearing shirts, most of them, just raggedy shorts and bulletproof feet. Bulletproof feet is a striking metaphor, the boys walking around in bare feet as if nothing on the ground could harm them. My students know that I am fond of quoting similes and metaphors from one of John Cheever's best stories, The Country Husband. The first is an extravagant simile. The living room was spacious and divided like gall into three parts. The next simile is both accurate and original. Frances limited herself to two weeknight parties, putting a flexible interpretation on Friday, and rode through the weekend like a dory in a gale. Cheever uses metaphor to set a mood. The sky was overcast and poured down onto the dirt crossroads a very discouraging light. Metaphors can enhance nonfiction also. Witness. In some cases, generally around public buildings like the White House and State Department, the protective cordon was saran wrap tight. One of my favorite metaphors was spoken by Clive James in his television series Fame. Hirohito was a 15-watt bulb. That metaphor is worth examining. It's a long stretch from the Emperor of Japan to a light bulb, but it sure makes its point instantly. I've suggested that you check your manuscript for similes and metaphors that strain too much. I'll add to that. In examining your work, can you find spots of bare-bones writing that could be improved by a simile or metaphor that you hadn't thought of when you were getting your early draft onto paper? Chapter 31. Increasing the effect on the reader through resonance. Resonance is a term borrowed from the world of music, where it means a prolonged response attributable to vibration. In writing, it has come to mean an aura of significance beyond the components of a story. Resonance can come from biblical associations. Call Me Ishmael instantly reverberates at the opening of Moby Dick. In this chapter, I show the many ways in which resonance can be produced, by names, by reference to religious sources, by invoking life and death, by a bold conclusion, by hyperbole, by naming the parts of a book, by the use of aphorisms and epigraphs, and ideally from the writing itself, by the writer's skillful use of similes and metaphors. Examples are drawn from important 20th century writers of both nonfiction and fiction. Writers who recognize resonance when they encounter it sometimes still have difficulty in providing reverberations in their own work. Help is on the way. Let's examine the ways of producing resonance through their sources. We have seen how the opening words of Moby Dick, "Call me Ishmael," have instant resonance because of the biblical associations of Ishmael. The same would be true of other memorable names from the Bible, whether used for characters or in appropriate phrases. Some commercial fiction has derived resonance from the use of public or historical characters. Put an Eisenhower or a Kennedy into a story and it resonates, especially if he appears fleetingly. I say fleetingly because most writers who try to reproduce historical characters at length, including their dialogue, usually fail. It's an area where a near miss is like taking just one misstep off a cliff's edge. Jack Higgins' career zoomed when he began using historical characters briefly in his thrillers. By referring to other religious sources. Evan Hunter, who writes also under the name of Ed McBain, is a superb craftsman. His novel Vespers draws some resonance from its title, but I would urge you to read at least the first 4.5 pages of that book to see how liturgy sends stunning resonance to a scene that involves a killing. By invoking death. In T. Corrigison Boyle's 1987 novel World's End, the author lends importance to a day by the use of a metaphor drawing on the possibility of the death of the earth. The day was typical of April in the Vale of the Hudson, raw and drizzling, the earth exhaling vapor as if it were breathing its last. In the last of his Rabbit Angstrom books, Rabbit at Rest, John Updike invokes his protagonist's death at the outset. Standing amid the tan, excited post-Christmas crowd at the Southwest Florida Regional Airport, Rabbit Angstrom has a funny sudden feeling that what he has come to meet, what's floating in, unseen, about to land, is not his son Nelson and his daughter-in-law Prue and their two children, but something more ominous and intimately his own death, shaped vaguely like an airplane. By a bold conclusion. To see how V.S. Naipaul, one of the outstanding writers in the English language in our time, uses a bold philosophical statement to lend resonance to the opening of his novel, A Bend in the River, let us look at the second sentence first. Nasruddin, who had sold me the shop cheap, didn't think I would have it easy when I took over. No resonance, but that sentence is preceded by this one. The world is what it is. Men who are nothing, who allow themselves to become nothing, have no place in it. That first sentence lends resonance to the sentence and paragraphs that follow, perhaps to the book as a whole. By invoking a setting that has greatly influenced the life of a person. Some writers of biography will describe the subject's birthplace in detail, but miss an opportunity for resonance. Bertram Wolfe began his biography, The Fabulous Life of Diego Rivera, with a setting that goes a long way toward explaining a source of Rivera's work. Guanajuato is flooded with light. The sun beats down with brilliant intensity upon its flat-roofed houses, fills with purple darkness their windows and doorways, gives bulk to solid forms, draws clean the line that separates surrounding hills from light-drenched sky. The valley in which the city dozes is 7,000 feet above the sea. Narrow cobblestone streets circle through the old center, then begin to climb into the hills. At the outskirts, trees become discouraged. Ridges rise bare and brown into a sky deep, remote, free from haze, standing out sharp against the light-filled emptiness of space. He whose eyes have been nourished on these clear forms, solid volumes, and light-filled space will never be altogether at home in the pale yellow sunlight and soft outlines of Paris treetops and towers, where the light is diffused by haze that forever hints of rain. A boy born here may get lost for a while in the Paris fashions of his day, and experiment inadequately with fugitive flecks of light and blurring washes of haze in which outlines waver, planes merge, and objects lose their volume, but he can never really find himself as a painter until he has rediscovered the strongly defined forms, pure colors, clear atmosphere, and omnipresent flood of light that gives solidity to all the objects it illuminates without seeming itself to appear upon the scene at all. You can imagine how I felt editing line by line a writer who used resonance to give the reader pleasure and instruction simultaneously the way Wolfe does. By hyperbole. A hyperbole is, of course, an exaggeration that is not meant to be taken literally. For the novelist, it presents an opportunity to lend resonance to what might otherwise seem ordinary. Here is Rebecca West's opening of The Fountain Overflows. There was such a long pause that I wondered whether my mama and my papa were ever going to speak to each other again. By the end of the first paragraph, Papa is apologizing to Mama, but the perception by the child narrator of a pause that seems terminal has magnified the importance of the moment of silence. For children, a pin drop of tension between parents can resonate like a thunderstorm. By naming the parts of a book. Omens are important in seeding suspense. The prolific British novelist Francis King lists 5 parts for his novel Act of Darkness. The first is titled simply Omens. It lends a touch of resonance even before the reader encounters the first sentence. A greater value can be derived from naming chapters in nonfiction. Orville Schell's 1994 book on China, Mandate of Heaven, has some chapter titles that evoke resonance twice in the table of contents and at the heads of chapters. A Hundred Flowers Fade evokes its familiar opposite, A Hundred Flowers Bloom. The Graying of Chinese Culture derives its effect through a metaphor that resonates. Shanghai on Commercial Fire also uses metaphor to resonate. By the thoughts and speech of a character. In The Blue Afternoon, a remarkable and highly praised novel by William Boyd, an early section is narrated by a character named Kay Fisher, an architect. She speaks in the first person. At one point, she says, "In architecture, as in art, the more you reduce, the more exacting your standards must be. The more you strip down and eliminate, the greater the pressure, the import on what remains. If a room is only to have one door and one window, then those two openings must conform exactly to the volume of space contained between the four walls, the floor, and the ceiling. My aesthetic mentor, my inspiration, in all this was the German architect Oskar Kronawitter, 1891-1929. He was a friend of Gropius and, like him, was heavily influenced by the austere ideologies of Johannes Itten." The reader absolutely believes that this narrator, Kay Fisher, is an architect. She is, of course, an invention of the author. Her thoughts about architecture provide the resonance that confirms her reality. Many years ago, I invented a character called Dr. Günther Koch, a foreign-born psychiatrist. In The Magician, I had him assert his theory of the three categories of people: those who set their own goals, those who are followers content to obey instructions, and those who burn with frustration because they refuse to follow, can't lead, and don't know what they want. When the book first appeared, I heard from psychiatrists who asked to be referred to the professional literature in which I had found that theory. I hadn't found it. I invented Dr. Koch's theory as resonance to authenticate Dr. Koch and his profession. In commercial fiction today, technobabble is used in a similar way. One of my students, a noted inventor, confirms that what writers do in these instances is the same as what inventors do, though the writer's inventions only need to seem to work. By the use of aphorisms. I can't recommend aphorisms as a technique for everyone, though my penchant for their creation has given me much pleasure. I use aphorisms in my character's dialogue. Here are a few examples from The Best Revenge, as spoken by Louis, a character who is dead when the book begins, which hasn't stopped him from rendering advice. "Of course the Bible was written by sinners. How else would they know?" Experience is what enables you to have a guilty conscience when you do something you know is wrong because you've done it before. If you think something is a coincidence, you don't know how God works. Pay attention. He doesn't have time to give you private lessons. "The best way to move is like a duck, calm on the surface, paddling like hell underneath. Save your breath. It's the devil who negotiates. God never made a deal with nobody." There are two points to remember about the use of aphorisms. If they are in the author's voice, the point of view has to be either the third person or the omniscient author's point of view, not the first-person point of view of a character. If they are in a character's dialogue, as in the case of Louis, you had better be sure the character you've created is the kind who could and would spout aphorisms on occasion. By the use of epigraphs. While aphorisms are your own, epigraphs can be other people's aphorisms and thoughts that lend a touch of resonance to your work. An appropriate epigraph can convey the larger import of a novel, without the novel itself becoming didactic. For instance, in The Magician, I used two epigraphs, one short, one long, both about the true subject matter of the novelist, human nature, and designed to lend resonance to the story even before it begins. The sources for epigraphs are many. There are quite a few collections of quotations on the market, with familiar quotations by John Bartlett, now updated by Justin Kaplan, the best known. There are also quotation collections available in software. If you haven't used the collections in book form previously, I would suggest a trip to your local library. Browse through Bartlett and any others they might have on hand. If you take to the experience, you might invest in buying a book of quotations. I found that browsing for possible epigraphs can sometimes provide additional reward in the paths it opens in a work in progress. Occasionally, a book will seem to be buying resonance insurance. William Styron, an admirable novelist, prefaces The Confessions of Nat Turner with 1. An author's note, in which Styron briefly relates the historical background for his novel, 2. A 3-page preface to a public document, a pamphlet published in Richmond in 1832 with the same title as Styron's novel, 3. A part title, Judgment Day, 4. A 5-line epigraph. An excess of preliminaries might be interpreted as defensive. Don't overdo it. The ideal resonance comes from the writing itself. Brooklyn-born Bertram D. Wolfe, whose biography of Diego Rivera was quoted from earlier, was a master of language who never wrote a word of fiction, but I have on occasion shown exemplary passages of his work to novelists for their instructive value. Here is how Wolfe began his masterpiece, Three Who Made a Revolution. The great Eurasian plain opposes few obstacles to frost and wind and drought, to migrant hordes and marching armies. In earlier centuries, the plain was dominated by vast Asiatic empires, Iranian, Turkish, Mongolian. As the last of these melted away, Muscovy expanded to take their place, expanded steadily through several centuries until it became the largest continuous land empire in the world. Like the tide over limitless flats, it spread with elemental force over an endless stretch of forest and steppe, sparsely settled by backward and nomadic peoples. Wherever it met resistance, it would pause, as the tide does, to gather head, then resume its inexorable advance. Only at the distant margins does the plateau end in great mountain barriers, the snowy summits of the Caucasus, the Pamirs, roof of the world, where two of our three protagonists have peaks named in their honor, thrusting up over 4 miles each into the sky, the Altai, Sayan, and Stanovoy Mountains forming China's natural wall. How could a people not be great and not aspire to greatness, whose horizon was as unlimited as this Eurasian plain? The visual sweep introduces a work of history with resonance that stems from the skill of the writing. Perhaps that is too much for a beginner to hope for, though I have read the work of relative beginners whose work already embodies the magic of resonance.